welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I guess the train of entertainment will really start ramping up now that we're in the throes of a presidential campaign. I mean, we're about a year out, and this is when it really goes into high gear, because just around the corner are the Iowa caucuses. And so we've got Paul with us, and Paul, we're right now wading through the Section 8, the delegated powers. Welcome right. back.
Thank you.
And yeah, I appreciate your willingness to come on to help go through this. As a matter of fact, because I'll just plow through it, and it doesn't mean that everybody kind of understands, you know, some of the stuff. And so, diving into it a little better is always better, right? Better's better. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Better is better. Yes.
All right. So I think we left off with the concept of the coins. Right, to coin money,
regulate the value thereof in a foreign coin and fix the standard of weights and measures.
Right.
That's where we are.
Okay, so the next power that has been delegated is to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and coin of the United States. Now, mm-hmm. what does that mean? That means that they have the ability to actually enforce a law. In other words, they're establishing a crime in mm-hmm. the Constitution and giving the federal government the authority, delegating to them to determine the punishment for counterfeiting and, you know, to actually, you know, try those cases and so forth. So, in other words, this is the first law that is given to the federal government for them to have cognizance over. You know, all other crimes are state matters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the first one that they've placed into the Constitution. And, you know, I could easily go down a tangent on this, and I will really quickly. It seems like over the past two decades, there has been a rampant effort in changing our currency. Actually, it goes back to the 90s when they started putting the magnetic strip in the coins. I believe it was $20 and greater.
And in the dollars, right?
Yeah, in the bills, right. And they were able to determine, because a friend of mine, a guy that was in the Marine Corps that was flying from California to Hawaii, had a few thousand dollars on him. He was, you know, mm-hmm. PCSing, and he was traveling, and I'll call it customs, but some federal agency seized his cash and said, you know, we're seizing this because we think it's drug money. And he goes, are you kidding me? And he gave his ID card and everything else. He goes, I don't do drugs. I'm in the intelligence community. And lo and behold, I don't know if he ever got his money back. It was just this long fight of trying to prove that he was innocent. In other words, they had gotten to a point where they were already, because is money not your property?
It is his property.
And isn't there?
So not only did he seize his property without probable cause, they kept it, and it just goes down so many wrong roads.
Right, but you can't seize property without just compensation.
Correct.
Okay, so anyway, now, go ahead.
This goes down another rabbit hole. I don't think it's a rabbit hole, but I'll tell you why this was so important to them. And you could probably give us more details on this. But during the Revolutionary War, the British brought ships over here to print continental dollars. Remember? They were counterfeiting continental dollars. And there was a British agent who George Washington hung because they caught him with counterfeit Continentals. This was so important to them that they wanted to give Congress the power to enforce laws against counterfeiting.
Now, I wasn't aware that they did that, but I am not surprised that the British did that. The when it comes, you know, so one of the things that most kids look at when they look at the Revolutionary War, Britain, they, you know, I'll just say my first thoughts was, boy, they sure are stupid. They're just standing there with their guns in line, making it real easy for them to get picked off. Why are they fighting a war that way? But and you would think that that was the only front that they were actually fighting us with. No, right. They were fighting us economically. They were fighting us creating division. I mean, it's almost like in some ways we see the onslaught of tyranny coming straight at us, but there's all of these things in the background that they were pulling on us to basically frustrate us, you know, creating, you know, division amongst the ranks or what have you. And that was really more within the people and the loyalists, which is one of the reasons why when it came to the end of the Revolutionary War, they actually pulled the trigger on the Tory Acts, because there was that many loyalists that got, you know, caught up in supporting the British in the Revolutionary War.
Right. Yeah, in fact, there's a paper in called The Successful British Counterfeiting of American Paper Money During the American Revolution by Eric Newman. And it was a very effective strategy.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
It hurt the colonies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Once you get all those counterfeited bills out into circulation, you've just inflated everything.
Right.
Right, so, yeah.
So when it, this, I think this is a particular point importance to the framers of the Constitution when they put this in here.
I agree.
I think that's why they raised it to that level of appointments, that they made it, that they gave this to Congress.
Right.
But it points out something else, okay, that didn't give Congress many other things to, you know, to police, right?
Uh-huh. That's okay. Right. Well, we're going to go through those because that's
we're going to go through those next. So, yeah.
Yes, right. Okay. Right. Okay, so the next one is to establish post offices and post roads. What does that mean?
Well, you know, I always thought that it was that they would establish roads so that the mail could go wherever it needed to go. Because that's, you know, people think post office and post roads. I didn't have any other documentation to tell me different, but I heard maybe in one of your shows in the last couple of years that you suggested that post roads were something different.
Yep. So, so post roads are the routes that the federal carrier will take. Mm-hmm. Nowhere here does it say that they will build. They will establish the post roads. So in other words, when you create a new state, when you create, you know, as the expanse goes and people start moving out there, then the federal government will determine when they finally need a, you know, nowadays it's a zip code, and so it's a post office, and the routes that they'll take. Now, in many cases, mail didn't go to your house. In many cases, it was general delivery, and it sat at the post office.
Right. And you went and picked it up.
Yes. In other words, you actually had to go pick it up, and they had your mail sitting there. And I have no idea how long they kept mail. But, you know, these were postal employees that, you know, were there serving the community. They were probably from the community and got the job. And so I think most of these folks were doing everything they could to make sure that, you know, they held on to the mail, especially those people that they knew. But this is how you contacted people when they traveled.
Right.
You know, you would send off a mail to, you know somebody's on travel out there and you need to get, you know, some word out to them. The mail was the only way to do it. And mm-hmm. so it would go to general delivery, and I believe that there would be a dispatch if it was somebody that was on official business traveling, then it would go, you know, to a dispatch from a postal center or postal office. And, right. they, you know, they would have somebody take it out to whomever because, you know, it's not like this guy is going to go to the post office to pick up a general delivery because he doesn't know it's coming.
Right.
Anyway,
that's
so
interesting.
So, you know, they didn't have the authority to build the roads. They were the ones that established them and said, these are the routes we're going to use.
Okay.
And so,
then it was up to state to build the roads?
Well, so 9 times out of 10, many of the roads were already done. Now, right. the federal government did have the responsibility of providing a route, a throughfare from the states to the capital. Because everything was, you know, the travel was on foot, horse, buggy, what have you. And mm-hmm. they didn't have trains, at least not yet. We talked about that yesterday. But they, you know, definitely not aircraft. And in some mm-hmm. cases, the best way to travel to D.C. was by ship if you lived on the coast.
Mm. Or if you lived in the river, because they did have canals, right?
Yeah, they did. They did
have river travel.
But I mean, you know, the coastline was where a lot of people lived, and those people who traveled, yes. You know, to D.C., they would just get on a ship. It would be a lot quicker, mm-hmm. or I should say, it would be less stressful and strainful, you know. And if you didn't have a horse, then you could just get there that way.
Right.
And so travel out to the port, and then, you know, sailing up to the Potomac and D.C., what have you. So, yeah, and the Potomac was a, you know, a ship-faring lane, you know, for access, because that's why the British was able to get up there with their navy and, you know, decimate it and burn it down. But
right.
But the point with post roads and post offices is that the federal government was to establish them. They didn't want the states to actually dictate where they wanted to put them.
Right.
Right.
Okay. I see what you're saying. So, okay. I keep thinking that there is a question I have here about post offices and post roads. It'll come back to me. Oh, you know that general delivery is still possible today. If you're traveling across the country and you want your mail, you can have it sent to you by general delivery to your nearest post office, and you can pick it up. I've done it.
Yes, and my mother-in-law used general delivery, period. I don't think she ever took mail. She always went down to the post office to get her mail. So I guess she didn't want the postman to know where she lived.
Well, and that's an option.
Yeah.
Really, it's an option. Fair. I think the other thing is, I think that in earlier times, in small communities, the post office was kind of like the meeting place.
Yes, just like churches, yes. Just like the bar.
Sure.
Yes.
Right.
So and everybody knew when the post came in, or I should say the parcels came in, because it wasn't like they came in every day.
Right.
Right. Because right. Okay. You probably had one courier that would, you know, bring out the mail, and then they would pick up the mail and take that back. And right. You'd have to wait till they came back again. So, you know, the postal and so here's the thing. We look at everybody complaining about the mail system. And, you know, there's this little problem with the fact that I believe the Crown owns our mail system now. For some reason, the federal government sold it off, or the corporation was bought out, whatever. But that's neither here nor there. The fact is that it's actually in the Constitution.
Okay.
So, in other words, they're obligated to support this. They're, mm-hmm. The only way that they cannot support this is by an amendment.
Okay. Right.
And so why is it that we're allowing them to marginalize and there's merit in really revamping the system. It would be nice to possibly go to a, because we do we need parcel carrying anymore?
What do you mean?
Do we need parcel carrying? Is there still a requirement? You know, there are still people out there that get hard checks. There's still people out there that get hard bills and those types of things. The question is, if we don't want to have, you know, the expense of the mail service, it requires an amendment. Is it worth amending the Constitution to basically remove that expense? Because if the Crown actually owns this and we basically say we're not servicing this anymore, then it becomes literally a private institution that they have to pay for.
Who's they?
The Crown. When I said that, the Crown owns our postal system.
That just opens all kinds of weird red flags that I think even your audience is going to be surprised about. I don't think I even had heard of this until maybe you mentioned it a couple months ago.
So I found out a long time ago that from our postal carrier who's, you know, when we lived down in a little patriotic pocket in California, that the Crown had bought it out. And I don't know when that was, but that's when it was after 9/11. And it was after, you know, the federal government started allowing foreign investment and foreign controls coming into America. Now, it's not like there was an amendment to the Constitution that basically said that the states allowed the federal government to, you know, put America up for sale. That never happened. It was just an assumed power. And they started doing that so that they could actually play with, you know, they moved that expense, they moved that off to somebody else. And now they have the ability to, you know, say, okay, that's not in our budget anymore. Now, I believe they still have the operations in the budget, but I believe the ownership of the resources, that type of stuff, I don't know how it is, but it was kind of, it wasn't explained to me. It was just basically I received the information that the Crown owned it, and I'm sure somebody out there can find all the details. Is it important? Well, yeah, it's important because it just goes down that path of how America is up for sale. And it proves that we're in that point where our government is selling off things that actually they have a hard requirement to support. I mean, whether we like it or not, again, they have to do this. They don't have to do welfare. They don't have to do a plethora of things, but they have to do this one thing. Anyway,
they do.
Anyway, so the next one we've got in the Constitution here is to promote the progress of science and useful arts. Now, what does that mean? Because there's a comma there. That's not a, you know, that's not a semicolon.
Okay.
So in other words, it's kind of like a little preamble to the clause. To promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings. And then they go, and so then they go down into these other things. But so that's how they're supposed to promote the progress of science and useful arts. They don't have any, there's nowhere here where they have any allowance to give money to science research or anything. In other words, some people think, oh, well, this is, you know, this gives us the ability to fund education. Where do you get that? To promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times. In other words, this is how they're going to do it. This is how they're going to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing patents and basically copyrights.
Correct.
And my problem is that we're at a point where patents and copyrights are so long that it actually hinders the progress of America.
Oh, it's not only that. They are, some things are patented that I don't know how to put, don't make sense to patent. You have large companies that patent. For example, I was in I've been in technology. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but at one point, Apple patented the option to click a link and make a phone call. Okay, so let's say you've got something, you're looking at something on your screen and there's a phone number and you click that, and Apple put a patent on your being able to make a phone call with one click. Anyone else, they had to do something, you had to go through more than one step. You had to copy it or and put it in your phone number, but no. And so that was just, it's small things like that. The other thing I think that happens is oftentimes the government will buy a patent. I never thought that the government was supposed to own this stuff. I thought it was for the benefit of people who created things to be used, you know, by other people to benefit, you know, the society at large for certain periods of time. And then it would probably become in the public domain after so many years, right?
Right. So you're right. They don't have any authority to possess property. In other words, if you look at, you know, the enumerations, the only property, because what you're talking about is a patent, is that's intellectual property.
Correct.
It may not be physical property, but it's still property. And there's nowhere in the Constitution where they have the right to possess that intellectual property. Now, they can control it. In other words, if you create an idea, if you create a, you know, some technology of communications or what have you, they can tell you that cannot be sold to anybody that can put it into these countries' hands, these people, what have you.
Right. And I've seen things like that.
Right. Correct. But they don't have the ability to own that, to say, you know, go out and pay for that and possess it. And here's the interesting thing. You're right that they do have these patents, and they basically design things for themselves, and they take ownership, and they keep the public from being able to do and use some of those things. You know, I don't know about Tang, but that was back in the time where, you know, things were still done in the private spectrum, and then came, you know, the research was done for that work, but, you know, it eventually became a product, right? Tang became a product.
Tang? You mean the orange-flavored drink?
Yes. Yeah, so Tang was an enriched, fortified orange-flavored drink that you just had to add water. And so when they went into space, it was developed so that they could actually, you know, add the Tang to the water if they wanted to have something other than water.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No,
so Tang was developed for the space program, and it, you know, it was then marketed for, you know, for America. So, or I should say for the consumers. And so things like that happened, but that was never where the government had that. It was later on, as they started taking greater ownership in, you know, intelligence processes and, you know, computers and those types of things, where they started creating ownership of software, ownership of software functions and those types of things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Anyway, so the next one, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. Now, we're running out of time. We actually have no time. I'll pick you back up after the break. So when we dive into the tribunals on the inferior courts, this is all about the federal court system and creating district courts so the people didn't have to travel all the way to D.C. Now, if you remember, after we just read the Federalist Papers, there are a lot of states that had contention with this. And so, you know, it was heavily debated. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're looking at the creation of these inferior courts. We call them tribunals, but anyway, and that was a common term. As a matter of fact, Madison in the Virginia Report actually called the states working together to interpose a tribunal. So anyway, if you remember during the ratification debates, there were a lot of people that were really concerned about creating, you know, having to go and defend themselves in D.C. And so one of the things that they said was, hold on here, you know, they're going to have the ability to create these inferior courts so you don't have to be dragged all the way across the countryside to, you know, be tried for, you know, for whatever. And here's the interesting thing as well. What were you going to be tried for? The only crime so far is for counterfeiting.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, when we really look at the different crimes that the federal government has, when we finally finish this, and we'll get through these pretty quickly, I didn't understand what the approbation was or the reservations that many of the anti-federalists had, other than the fact that they were just grasping for straws. I did see the problem of the federal courts actually being able to step in between a private person and another state. In other words, a state that they didn't reside in, somebody suing that state. I saw that as a problem. But, you know, trying to step in because what a person can't get justice, and, you know, like the court of that state is going to be so biased. Well, so the reality is the one court that has and actually is proven to have such bias, let's just call it bias, you know, a predetermined outcome will always favor the federal government in a federal court. So I can see how, you know, we can see, you know, that bias. But anyway, the whole point was to create these district courts so that you would have an opportunity to, you know, hear your case at a court of appeal if you're not happy with the outcome. The problem was that we didn't have – what the states didn't do is they didn't create a turnstile in the front of these federal courts.
Okay.
And I'll say this because, you know, looking at Baker v. Carr, Baker v. Carr was a case that went straight into the federal court. I've been looking and looking, and I can't find any evidence that it was actually brought into a state court. In other words, the plaintiff basically felt that they couldn't, you know, because they went to the Secretary of State, and I think that was Carr, Joe Carr, and whoever Baker was. Baker was claiming that they didn't have the appropriate representation, you know, for the amount of people in their legislative district, and basically that was a county. And they wanted more. Well, who doesn't want more representation? And the problem was is that what they needed into this is a Tennessee case. And, you know, Baker said, hey, I, you know, we have a right to have this kind of, equal representation. Well, and this is what's going into why counties matter most. Show me in the Constitution where the federal government has any responsibility, role, power, or property over the apportionment of a state and their representation. Do they have any authority over state apportionment? Now, they have authority over the apportionment of federal districts, you know, congressional districts, but that's it. There's nowhere in the Constitution that gives them any control of saying, states, you have to form yourself this way. And so this is where the principle of voting. So let's look at all of the different doors that they could have gone down this path. Okay, so if they didn't have jurisdiction because of apportionment, because the federal government, remember, the federal court's jurisdiction is tied to all things arising under this Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, then it can't go into a federal court.
Mm-hmm.
And so the apportionment, that's not in the Constitution for the state apportionment.
It's not in the U.S. Constitution.
It's not. How a state decides to do its apportionment, it's up to the state. And as when that state actually is created as a state and the federal government says, yay, verily, you have, you know, that Constitution is not in conflict with our Constitution, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, somebody started complaining because they say, well, you know, when we vote, our representation doesn't have equal suffrage. Well, equal suffrage is not in, as far as state legislature, equal suffrage is not within the U.S. Constitution either.
Right.
There's equal suffrage in the Senate in Article 5 for the U.S. Congress Senate, but not state
right.
Senate.
For the states, right?
Nothing for the states regarding equal suffrage and representation. Nothing. Now, when we look at voting alone, you know, a person being able to vote for their representative, and this principle that supposedly got developed out of the federal courts, one person, one vote principle. In other words, democracy, that's not mm-hmm. in the Constitution either, where a person is guaranteed equal, you know, power of their vote. So how did this get into the federal court, other than the fact that we had federal jurists, and I've got a page that really identifies which jurist, you know, approved and which jurist said, hey, this is, we don't have jurisdiction, and how mm-hmm. they opened their doors, how the Supreme Court opened their doors to actually, you know, shred the state's, you know, Republican form of government, and you basically put a huge hole in the Constitution to say we have this power when they didn't. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the whole process and the real problem right here, it's one thing that they had the ability to constitute these inferior courts, and it's, you know, that they have this jurisdiction. What I am saying is the states should have created a turnstile. In other words, a litmus test that it you had to prove that what was going into the federal court was mm-hmm. arising under this Constitution.
Right.
And if it's something that is actually arising under this Constitution, let's say the Convention of States, that's mm-hmm. in the Constitution. So it can easily and quickly go into a federal court, and it can quickly go into the hands of Congress and the federal government. But when we look at, let's look at the individual privileges and immunities. Now, if a state is, you know, violating the individual privileges and immunities, is that a federal case?
It can be.
It can be.
Because of the 14th Amendment.
Because the 14th right? Amendment. However, it has to go through the federal. It should. I mean, the turnstile should basically say, hey, you can't enter into the federal court without having this heard in a state court.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? So
well,
in
sure
other words, if the state does not give you, you know, justice and you have to appeal, then, and this is the other problem I have, is that when the state courts actually rule badly And it is determined that, you know, we got a problem with the judge. We've got a problem with the jury or the court itself, that the court actually should have said, hey, we, you know, we're required to deliver justice, not an outcome, like, you know, letting somebody go because of, you know, their race, color of their skin, you know, whatever demographics, whatever. In other words, the court's obligated to ensure this justice as well as ensuring compliance of the Constitution. So in addition to a turnstile over jurisdiction, I honestly believe that when state courts, because, again, lower courts tend to make mistakes, then when they make mistakes, that should be considered bad behavior.
Doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room, does it?
You know what? When it comes down to becoming a public servant and being accountable, you know, we have to have some standards, don't we?
Of course we do.
And if we don't have standards, then we get what we deserve.
Okay,
so moving on. Here's the next crime, the next adding to the list of crimes. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses, in other words, to define and punish offenses against the laws of nations. So right here, they're actually adding the jurisdiction for the federal government over all United States citizens. So in other words, what just happened in this particular line is they basically said any U.S. citizen traveling abroad or inhabitant under the United States, let's say you're not even a citizen, you haven't become a citizen of the United States, you're just an inhabitant, and you travel.
But you're subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
But you're subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
Okay.
And so the federal government has the jurisdiction in federal, in these international courts to actually, you know, pull that person back from the international court to say, we have supreme jurisdiction over offenses against the laws of nations or these piracies and felonies. The reason they did this is because Britain was already seizing people, seizing our ships and impressing, you know, sailors and so forth into slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, these felonious crimes and what have you. So the whole intent was is to ensure justice was being delivered, for, you know, so that people wouldn't be, you know, basically found guilty of trumped up charges in a kangaroo court.
Right.
So
this.
Go ahead.
This has interesting implications. So in other words, we extend. You know, we've got people traveling abroad, and the Constitution extends the protection to those people essentially wherever they are in the world. And we claim jurisdiction, even though another country may, when you say laws of nations, let's say where someone breaks a law in another country.
So actually, the laws of nations was an agreed set of laws that how other nations would deal with each other's inhabitants, citizens, and so forth. The laws of nations, actually, that's why it's called capitalized, laws of nations, is, and you can actually get a book, Montesquieu, The Spirit of the Laws of Nations, and so forth, where they actually go through what the laws of nations were. And you should be able to find a document of the times of the 1780s of what the current laws of nations were, because the nations actually, because they were civilized, they actually got into a room and said, okay, well, you know, what are we going to do about this? And one of those, just so people understand this, one of the areas of laws were the laws of conquest. Mm-hmm. And I use the word conquest. It may have been called something else, but because I was actually talking to Keith Broders about this about a week ago, because he called up and said, you know, he felt that America was actually in the wrong. And I go, actually, you mean Britain? And actually, no. When it came to following the laws of nations, the inside the laws of nations were very specific standards that the conquering nation had to treat the inhabitants in a very specific way. And now, the nations, then let me finish that. The nations that treated the inhabitants that outright violated the laws of nations were Portugal, Spain, you know, and those Mediterranean nations, Italy and so forth.
Okay. Now, this opens up all kinds of questions, which we may cover at some point. But one, apparently the law of nations was something that, and I'm not speaking of the United Nations, I'm speaking of an agreement among nations about how they would treat each other and their and the people that they are under their power, jurisdiction, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, or how they would treat each other's people. And this is an understood law. Maybe this is a treaty when you speak of the law of nations.
Well, so...
Okay?
So
or an understanding.
Yes, and so within the laws of nations is this demarcation of jurisdiction, which is why they actually put this in here.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had to claim in the Constitution jurisdiction regarding their citizens, you know, when it came to crimes committed against the laws of nations.
And okay. Is that recognized today?
The laws of nations? No. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it because of Western expanse and other, you know, changes and so forth, they, you know, kind of disbanded. And then I wouldn't say they disbanded, but Wilson's League of Nations was the next effort to actually create even a more powerful doctrine of subjugating all nations to a single governing body. The laws of nations were just agreed upon. This is how we're going to interact with each other. And the League of Nations basically came in and said, we're going to create laws and hold you accountable, which is completely different. And the United Nations is the same way. Once you become a member, then you're going to be held accountable and could be punished or what have you for violating the laws that you've subjugated yourself to. And both the League of Nations and the United Nations are agreements, or I should say affiliations. We've created this affiliation via treaty that's unconstitutional, because treaties cannot be made if they don't have the jurisdiction, if there's no enumerated power in the Constitution to allow the United States government to subjugate it, the United States government, and the sovereign states to another government and hold them accountable to those laws, then they can't do it. That treaty itself is unconstitutional. You know, when I say these things, I'd expect this nation to kind of tremble a little bit. You know, when people would hear this, it would be like, you know, or this bright epiphany that would be blinding from sea to shining sea. The people go, ah, I get this. This is the magnitude of tyranny we're living under. They've just been making up all sorts of things to enslave us without the authority to do that. Go ahead.
Let me ask you one more question. This is something you mentioned it. I didn't want to get from it that there are certain laws that governed conquering nations.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Would you explain that for a minute? In other words, there was an agreement globally.
Yes.
That if you were a conquering nation, you did things a certain way.
Yes. Yeah,
and you
couldn't rape, torture, and just outright kill the inhabitants, the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't supposed to do. I mean, it's one thing to be engaged in hostilities and those types of things, but you were supposed to treat them justly. We were a civil society. Western society was a very civil society, and we weren't there to rape and pillage. And when you look at how Portugal and Spain and other nations had conducted themselves in contrast to England. Now, let me just say this. Maybe we got it, you know, maybe by the graces of the Lord, because there wasn't any gold and any value in the Americas, that, you know, they said, okay, well, instead of, you know, stealing a bunch of gold and jewels, what we'll do is we'll create an economic development, and we'll go in and start extending ourselves. And because it was these were conquests, right? This was the colonization. Mm-hmm. Every nation in the world was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just talking about Western nations. In Asia, they were doing this as well. This is why you'll find that the Chinese were, there was a high concentration of Chinese in the Philippines and throughout that part of Asia to create mm-hmm. economic portals. And they were doing it to actually do importing and exporting. As a matter of fact, Thomas Sowell in Black Rednecks, White Liberals talks about middleman minorities and how certain cultures like the Jews, the Chinese, and so forth were, just really good at getting and penetrating into developing nations and then start, mm-hmm. Using their connections in the old world to bringing in, these goods and services, diamonds, jewels or what have you, to sell to these developing nations.
Right.
And so that's, that actually goes back even to the Bronze Age and even beyond that. So it was just a common trait of humanity of, growing and expanding. Now, it's said that China has never really gone on a conquest to conquer, but that's not true. Who was Genghis Khan? And what did Genghis Khan do? But Genghis Khan did not go out to claim, all of this land and these nations, for the motherland. He just went out and said, let me find an army that can beat me. And then he went back home and said, there's nobody out there that can beat me. And you can go back to even Alexander the Great. I mean, when you start looking at these extensive, expanses of military force and so forth, I think the two societies that were probably the most brutal was the Egyptians and the Romans, because those empires, really expanded themselves and seized control. They weren't conquesting. They were just seizing control and subjugating all of these other nations. It's not like Rome was actually, creating these states as new states into the nation. Rome had its own core Senate, and it's not like the Senate continued to grow for representation of the world. Does that make sense?
Right.
So,
yeah.
They were very, I'll just say, they were very brutal societies. And in the in the past 500 years, Portugal and Spain were the two brutal societies that came out of, what we would call the laws of nations, and I think that they just didn't even care. And I don't think they were ever held accountable.
So, but they liked, when you say there wasn't gold, you mean in North America? Because didn't Portugal and Spain extract a lot
absolutely.
Of gold?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm just saying that maybe it's because those nations couldn't resist those treasure troves that they found.
Okay.
Maybe Britain, kind of really got the luck of the straw, or, drawing the straw and saying, we don't have a good straw because we can't just steal all this stuff. So maybe they would have had it been there, but America, mm-hmm. America, the tribes of America that basically came, from however everything evolved from the fall of the Mayans and the Aztecs, what have you, but the Indian tribes of North America, especially from like Mexico north, those were nomadic tribes. I think the only mm-hmm. tribe that, and I think we talked about this before, was the Navajo, where they actually, claimed land and they had houses and they weren't nomadic. They didn't, mm-hmm. drive for the season to go kill buffalo and run them off the cliffs and that type of stuff. So, anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So where are we now?
So the next one is to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water.
Okay.
So the only entity that has the authority to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal. So if you look at the Civil War, mm-hmm. Lincoln did both of those.
Okay.
Lincoln, Lincoln basically did everything here that he had no authority to do. This was for Congress to have these powers. And you will not find any delegation or Congress doing it and saying, yeah, we're going to let you do this. Mm-hmm. Period. And so that's why this is orange, and that's why this has been violated, and we've actually had, you know, presidents that have actually done things that have gone out and captured stuff and so forth, where, you know, it's not been done by Congress. Mm-hmm. Captures on water, land. Did the capturing of Osama bin Laden, was that an order from Congress?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I don't think it was.
All right. No, and it was a violation, a direct violation of the Constitution by Obama. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know. There may have been a secret, but you have to have Congress, not some committee empowered to do it. You have to have Congress call for that capture.
Right.
See? That's why it's highlighted, because the president has assumed far more authority. And this kind of goes back to the Whiskey Rebellion, when Congress just felt that, you know, maybe we can trust this guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. George Washington, okay. But some of these other guys? Okay, yeah, so the next one is interesting, because here they have the power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer than a term of 2 years. And this was the concept. See, you don't see the term standing armies.
Right.
And so the point was that they were supposed to only call forth, and this army, to raise and support armies, was what? Well, we'll jump down to provide for calling forth the militia. So this is when they call and provide forth the militia. This is when they raise and support armies.
Yeah, we probably ought to spend a little more time on this tomorrow.
Okay.
We're about to run out of time.
We got a minute left, so we don't want to brush over this. Okay, that's fair enough. But the one thing that they have a standing requirement to do is to provide and maintain a navy. And we've talked about this. Why didn't Washington do this? Why didn't we, you know, see, I mean, Adams was the one that really started doing it. And then, you know, he got a lot, I'll just say Jefferson gave him some flack. But as soon as Jefferson got in office, boy, he was pretty happy he had a little navy and some Marines to send into Tripoli.
Right.
And so the one force that we actually needed to develop, you know, faster than anything else was the Navy. So, folks, that's the end for this show. This is still Section 8 of Article 1 that we're going through. So when we come back, we'll get the last half of this, hopefully, in our next show. So we'll be back, and I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.